questions always remained as to whether it was loaded correctly. "It's kind of like testing flashbulbs," said one tech. "The only way to test it is to run it through a camera, develop the film, and see what the images look like. If they look okay, you say, 'That was good.' But now I have to load another one." You had to have someone who knew what they were doing to load these things in a reliable way. If somebody did it all the time, the loading required about 15 minutes. Since you couldn't test each one, the best you could do was treat and package each one with care. The exacting work required to mount a loaded camera in its concealment and the precision needed to load the film was a job for the techs. Attempts to instruct agents on how to remove the camera from the concealment and insert a replacement proved to be extraordinarily difficult. TSD routinely found the threads of the concealment misaligned, stripped, or the camera improperly mated with the tension spring. After several frustrating operational failures, TSD began resupplying agents not just with film, but an entirely new camera. This eliminated virtually all mechanical failures, although inadequate light, shadows over a document, or focusing problems would continue to degrade photo quality. The second generation camera, the T50, was issued to George for Trigon's training. The T50 had all the technical and engineering features of the T100, but held only 50 frames. The smaller film capacity represented a performance compromise by the design engineers to improve the overall reliability of the camera. Field experience with the T100 revealed that the tiny film advance mechanism was fragile and prone to inconsistent performance. By changing the clutch and sprocket design, the engineers eliminated the problem at the sacrifice of some film capacity. An internationally recognized luxury pen was reproduced for Trigon's camera concealment. The expensive-looking pen would not be out of place in a diplomat's pocket, and it matched Ogorodnik's fondness for the finer things in life. Fabricated by one of America's most reputable pen manufacturers through a classified contract with OTS, the thick-bodied pen looked and worked like its commercial namesake, though a smaller ink sac and imperceptibly shorter base for the nib created a cavity for the spy camera. Before Trigon's training began, George perfected his own expertise with the T50 by spending hours practicing clandestine photography techniques around agency headquarters and in the local library. He would carry the pen in his pocket, select a book or magazine, sit at a desk with others, and take covert photos. Repeatedly, George positioned his elbows on a table, forearms at an angle, hands together, and tried to establish a comfortable position. At home, with a ruler, he practiced using different postures to develop a feel for the exact 11-inch distance from lens to document. No one seemed to notice. After shooting several rolls, George returned the film to OTS, where his work was developed and critiqued. After an intense month of practice, George was finally confident of his own expertise with the camera. Flying into Colombia under an alias, he checked into the Bogota Hilton to begin a Spartan existence. He minimized interaction with other Americans and purposely avoided the embassy and government officials. The CIA officer handling the case arranged clandestine meetings with George to coordinate activities and pass instructions, but made no effort to lessen the pressure. George knew the importance of Trigon to SR Division, and with the operation based in Colombia, the Latin American division chief was also watching closely. The case officer had done his job recruiting Trigon. Now everything depended on the performance of the camera and operational training. The first thing George would need to determine was Trigon's aptitude for learning the clandestine skills to operate the T-50. His first impression of Trigon was, "This guy is smart." The training was in Russian, and George, conscious that his Russian was not native, repeatedly confirmed the instructions were understood and that he was using the correct verbs and sentence structure. The training began with 35mm cameras to familiarize the agent with basic photographic techniques, equipment, and film. The camera selected was the Pentax OM-1, a $200 product that a Russian diplomat could reasonably acquire during an overseas assignment. Trigon quickly grasped the instruction, and his practice photos produced nearly perfect results. George then demonstrated the modified pen, emphasizing the critical importance of discreetly getting the body geometry of hands and elbow positioned and taking the picture without compromising the camera. Recalling his month-long self-training process, George knew just how hard this could be while also consciously maintaining situational awareness. Awareness of the environment while performing a clandestine act was a fundamental lesson Trigon's life depended on. "When I did this," George recalled telling Trigon, "the hardest part for me was sitting in an office. Suddenly, either I'd catch myself paying no attention to the camera or no attention to what was going on around me. It's difficult to maintain that split personality." Training progressed fitfully over several weeks, with Trigon sneaking away for small blocks of time that did not disrupt his normal pattern of activity or catch the notice of the KGB. On one occasion, he left a few minutes early for an appointment at the Cultural Society, taking a route that included a visit to the Hilton. On another day, after giving a talk to the Bogota Chamber of Commerce about Soviet assistance to Latin America, he stopped at the Hilton before returning to the embassy. These unscheduled training sessions could last between 15 minutes and 2 hours, and George never knew when his pupil might arrive. Confined to his hotel room and fighting boredom, he waited for Trigon to knock on the door and say, "I've got 15 minutes," or "I've got an hour." Trigon proved a fast learner, but George understood it was one thing to perform flawlessly in the safety of the training environment with the instructor, and quite another to operate spy equipment alone with no support. However, whatever concerns George had about the agent's courage were soon put to rest when, during one of the rushed training sessions, Trigon dropped a bombshell. "There's a new, highly restricted Soviet policy paper on China that has just come into the embassy, and I should be able to have access to it," he told George one day. George did not encourage Trigon to photograph the document, since his training on the camera was not completed, and top-level policy papers were not readily accessible, even to diplomats. Trigon had the security clearance for the information, but the document itself was closely guarded. The policy paper was being held in the referentura, and its control involved signing out the document from a custodian, then reading it while a guard observed the room through a small viewing port. The instruction continued, and after 3 more successful practice sessions, Trigon departed the room with the loaded pen, saying, "I may be able to do this." Twice he returned to George, describing the security in the area and showing the strain of the risk he was taking. "After I get to the room, a guy walks behind me. I couldn't use the camera," he said. "You know what will happen if I make a mistake." George sympathized with the agent's anxiety. "We would like you to do this," he replied, "and I can tell that you would like to do it, but it's not worth your life. Just keep thinking about it. This is good practice for when you are back in Moscow, although it won't be as difficult there, since you should be able to take documents to your own office." A few days later, Trigon reappeared at the hotel room door, smiling. "I think I've got it," he said. After Trigon departed, an elated George went to a public phone outside the hotel, called the tech standing by in another part of town, and passed the verbal parole for an emergency meeting. Securing the pen, still loaded with exposed film, in a money belt, George headed out. Fearful of taxi muggings, he walked for more than an hour to pass the pen to the tech, who then caught the next plane to Washington, hand-carrying the treasure. The report George received was astonishing. When the film was processed, only 2 frames out of 50 were illegible. All significant contents of the policy paper had been captured. With more than 20 years in Soviet operations, this was, to his knowledge, the first time that top-secret documents had ever been photographed by a CIA agent inside a Soviet embassy's referentura. Trigon had more than proven he could use the T-50 operationally. The report added that the information had gone to the 7th floor at headquarters, from whence the DCI hand-carried it to Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who was quoted as saying that the copied document was the most important piece of intelligence that he had read as Secretary of State. Trigon had yet another surprise in store for George at the end of the next training session. He said, "Oh, and by the way, please get me something to kill myself, in case I think I'm going to be caught." Despite the fiction in espionage novels, lethal substances, called L-pills, were rarely deployed and not available as an off-the-shelf stock item from OTS. Only when an agent could not be dissuaded, and after approval by the DDP himself, would an L-pill be produced. George reported the request to the case officer, who cabled it to headquarters. An immediate answer firmly stated that the request had been reviewed by the Soviet division chief and the deputy director for operations, and the answer was no way. Since this was an agent-handling matter, the case officer broke the news to Trigon that his request had been denied. An L-pill would not be issued. "Okay, fine. I won't be working for you anymore," Trigon replied. A furious field-to-headquarters cable exchange followed. Headquarters asked if the agent was bluffing. The case officer asked George's assistance in preparing a considered response. Trigon and his handler, even prior to the steam room recruitment, had spent considerable time together in Bogota. And while Trigon did not speak English, the case officer, who was fluent in Russian and Spanish, used both languages to build confidence and trust. Their relationship included informal evenings sitting on street corners at night, drinking and talking about politics, philosophy, and personal interests. The case officer was certain he knew Trigon the person as well as Trigon the agent, and George had just spent several intense weeks training the diplomat in espionage. The two agreed the cable should read, "Either he gets an L-tablet, or we don't have an operation." OTS was instructed to produce an L-pill and conceal it in the barrel of a pen identical to the one that held the camera. With his tour in Colombia at an end, Trigon returned to Moscow in 1975 as part of the normal pattern of diplomatic rotation. From the agency's perspective, Trigon could not have received a better Moscow assignment. Appointed to a key post in the American Department of the Soviet Foreign Ministry, Trigon's job gave him access to read and photograph reports from Soviet ambassadors around the world. Since Soviet officials returning from overseas were watched carefully by the KGB for signs of corruption, no immediate contact was attempted. Then, after a cooling-off period of several months, Trigon recovered a dead drop containing new one-time pads, a COMO plan, and the T-50 spy camera. Thereafter, he began providing a steady stream of documentary intelligence detailing Soviet policy, confirming the quality of both his training and equipment. To maintain operational security, with a single exception, Trigon never met his Moscow case officer. The operation relied on communications conducted using OWVL and written instructions passed through dead drops. Trigon never met the case officer who loaded and unloaded the drops. Had he done so, he likely would have been shocked. Martha Peterson arrived in Moscow in 1975. She worked a regular 8-hour daily cover job, improved her Russian language skills, and kept a low profile. For the KGB watchers, she merited little attention. Only on her scheduled breaks, lunch hours, and nights did she assume the responsibility of handling a spy she would never meet, the CIA's highest-placed agent in Moscow. A young woman, dressed in the latest fashions and doing a woman's administrative job, was not how the KGB envisioned a CIA officer. If Peterson did not fit the KGB profile of agency personnel in the USSR, she did not fit the traditional CIA-denied-area case officers either. She had won the coveted assignment due to the insistence of the office chief, who had been impressed by her earlier operational work. From the time of his recruitment in Colombia, Trigon had proven himself to be a productive agent. Then, in the spring of 1977, The operation took a turn for the worse. The first indication that something was wrong surfaced when communication schedules between the agent and CIA broke down. Finally, an early July OWVL radio message was sent to Trigon instructing him to put out the standard meeting signal by parking a car in a specific location at a specific time. Uncharacteristic of his normal responsiveness, no car appeared at the site. However, a second request for an alternate signal, a red lipstick mark on a child crossing pole, did elicit the appropriate response. The red mark appeared on the pole the next day. The signal indicated Trigon would pick up a package at a predetermined time and designated dead drop site. On July 15th, Peterson made a point to leave work on time. For the next 4 hours, she walked, rode, drove, and used public transportation, executing a carefully constructed surveillance detection run. Her single operational act that night would be to load a dead drop for Trigon. She had conducted more than a dozen similar operations during the previous 18 months. As in the past, she encountered no problems or indication that KGB surveillance might be following her. The dead drop site was a window crevice in one of the arched pillars along the footpath on the Krasnolushki Bridge that spans the Moscow River. Peterson carried an OTS concealment fabricated to look like a piece of asphalt debris in her shopping bag. The relatively flat 6x8x4 inch black rock was sealed with reversed screws and rubbed with soil and mud to give it a dirty look. The cavity was filled with small denomination Russian rubles held tight with a rubber band, a resupply of 6 loaded T-50 camera bodies, some jewelry, a pin concealment, new COMO schedules, one-time pads, contact lenses, and a personal note on Kalvar film. Included in the package was a cautionary note in Russian that read, "Comrade, you have penetrated into another secret. Take the money and the valuables, the rest throw into a deep place in the river, and forget about all of this. You have been warned." Should someone other than Trigon stumble across the container, the note, with its threatening message, might persuade them to dispose of the package instead of reporting the find to the KGB. Dusk was darkening into night when Peterson finished her surveillance detection run. Confident that she had no surveillance, she loaded the dead drop at 10:30 p.m., pushing the concealment as far back as her arm could reach into the crevice, and then walked a few steps to a long staircase that descended from the bridge. Just before she reached the bottom, three men suddenly appeared in front of her and grabbed her arms. Immediately, a van pulled out from under the bridge, and a dozen more KGB officers piled out. Sensing the KGB's surprise at finding a woman loading the dead drop, she took advantage of the momentary confusion and screamed, "Provocation!" If Trigon was in the area, the shout and the ruckus might warn him away. In a brief struggle that followed, Peterson's green belt Taekwondo instinct flared, and she landed one painful kick to the groin of a Russian before being subdued. The KGB recovered the dead drop container and its contents. Peterson was also searched, and the KGB found, velcroed to her bra, an OTS-developed frequency scanner used to intercept surveillance radio transmissions. Peterson's necklace was the scanner's induction coil antenna. Thinking the scanner was a communication device, the KGB officers talked into the black box in an attempt to elicit a response from another party. Throughout the ordeal, the small receiver Peterson wore remained undiscovered. Peterson was then driven to Lubyanka, headquarters of the KGB's second directorate, where questioning began. Within a short time, calls were made to the U.S. Embassy with news that an American citizen had been arrested. The State Department representative who arrived at Lubyanka was as surprised to see Peterson in custody as the KGB was to see her at the bridge. By 2 a.m., she had been released. The next day, the Soviet government declared her persona non grata and ordered Peterson out of the country. She left on the first flight out of Moscow without ever returning to her apartment. The CIA later learned that Trigon had been dead for at least a month before Peterson's apprehension, compromised by Carl Kosher, half of the Carl and Hannah Kosher husband and wife spy team. The Koshers were Czech nationals sent to the United States in 1965 under the control of the Czech Intelligence Service, the Staní tajné bezpečnost, STB. Claiming to have fled their homeland in search of freedom in America, they posed as virulent anti-communists. Carl earned a degree from Columbia University and then landed a translator job at the CIA. The STB shared reports from its agents with the KGB and whatever information Kosher gleaned from his translation work about a Soviet diplomat working for the CIA in Colombia was enough for the Soviets to launch an investigation that eventually identified Ogorodnik. Precise details of Trigon's death remain clouded, but his early insistence in having an L-pill was prescient, at least according to an account of the death of Agent Trianon, written in 2000. Trianon is clearly Trigon. The author, a retired KGB officer, Igor Peretrukin, who claimed he led the investigation, described Trianon sitting in his apartment surrounded by KGB officers at 2 a.m. Trigon requested paper and a pen to write an explanation addressed to the KGB leadership. He then requested his own fountain pen that was laying on the table and which one of the KGB officers had inspected. The pen received another, more thorough examination before being given to Trigon. As he began writing, Trigon slowed down and fiddled with the pen. When no one was near the table where he was writing, Trigon managed to disengage the L-pill and get it into his mouth. Suddenly, he quivered, leaned against the back of his chair, and began to wheeze. The KGB officers rushed to him, and with a metal ruler tried unsuccessfully to open his firmly clenched teeth to find the suspected poison ampule. Foaming blood began coming out of Trigon's mouth. He never regained consciousness. Carl Kosher was arrested in New York City on November 27, 1984, and charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. He served less than 2 years in prison before a swap for imprisoned Soviet dissident Anatoly Sharansky allowed him and his wife to return to Czechoslovakia. Chapter 9. Fire in the Arctic. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. John 8:32. Inscription at the entrance of CIA's original headquarters building. The death of Trigon and arrest of Martha Peterson were bitter victories for the KGB. The Soviets may not have known Trigon had been an active agent for more than 4 years, but they certainly would have understood the significance of the information he provided. Trigon did not hold the most senior of Soviet government ranks, but had access to documents containing vital national secrets. Unlike Penkovsky, there would be no public trial, during which Trigon's pet poodle and South American mistress would be submitted as evidence of moral degradation and individualism. Worse for the KGB, Trigon's suicide precluded any kind of interrogation and follow-up damage assessment of what he may or may not have handed over to the Americans. They would have to assume the worst, and the worst was significant. Throughout his tenure in Moscow, Trigon had access to some of the most sensitive policy and planning documents in the ministry, including those pertaining to the Soviet negotiating positions during the strategic arms limitations talks. Trigon supplied the type of vital intelligence that fed directly into the poker game of realpolitik diplomacy and military threat assessment at a critical juncture in the Cold War. It was intelligence that could not be gained from the technology of satellites, the open sources of Soviet media, or a defector who fled across the border at night. It was also perishable information, the sort of intelligence that required continuous refreshing to track shifts in the dynamics of international relations. Only a human agent with the tools to copy documents, record conversations, prepare secret correspondence, and communicate regularly with his handlers could acquire it. The KGB did not provide accurate details of its investigation beyond those printed as propaganda in Pravda and other government-controlled media outlets. However, from the KGB's counterintelligence perspective, It was now painfully apparent that the CIA was capable of running agent operations in denied areas, including Moscow. It was as if a banker, supremely confident in his massive safe, alarm system, and armed guards, had suddenly realized a doorway had been cut at the rear of the vault. There could be little doubt that secrets in Moscow, and the entire Soviet bloc, were now vulnerable to American intelligence, and technology was playing an essential role. The level of American communications and collection technology, evident in the subminiature cameras and the surveillance receiver, confirmed a new level of technical capabilities available to American agents and case officers in the field. For the KGB, early evidence of America's technical sophistication occurred in 1974 with the discovery of a ground sensor. Concealed as a tree stump near an Air Force base, the device was crammed tight with electronics capable of capturing and transmitting radio data from the airfield. Now Trigon's roll-up confirmed that advanced technology was also in the hands of agents. Dead drops, signal sights, and one-time pads were still used by the Americans, but operations were evolving. It did not require great imagination by KGB leadership to envision that soon these time-honored pieces of tradecraft would soon be supplemented or supplanted entirely with a new generation of ingenious devices that would move agent communications from the street to the airwaves. Peterson presented yet another problem for the KGB officers of the Second Directorate. Because she was not a stereotypical case officer by KGB standards, Peterson's cover work fit cultural and professional expectations of Western women in Moscow. For nearly 2 years, the immense Soviet security apparatus apparently had not focused on her activities. "When they caught Marty Peterson, I think that opened their eyes a lot," observed an officer intimately involved with the case. The KGB had done its best to create a cold, dark, inhospitable, Arctic-like environment for agent operations in Moscow. For years, both the reality and myth of the KGB's blanket surveillance capability contributed to caution bordering on paralysis when it came to aggressive operational efforts. However, instructions given the new Moscow chief by his superiors in early 1973 were to go out there and shake things up. TSD chief Sid Gottlieb conveyed a similar message to the techs. "You are not here to fiddle around with the technical gadgets," he directed. "I'm sending you there to become part of their operations and use our gadgets wherever they think will help." Over the next 2 years, the combination of new tradecraft and technical gear would revolutionize the operational environment in Moscow. Fire was being carried to the Soviet Arctic. Traditionally, new CIA officers received a block of basic technical training during the 6-month-long intensive tradecraft course required by the DO. This instruction included photography with a 35mm Minox and some sub-miniature cameras, principles of developing and printing 35mm film, lockpicking, sketching of operational sites, secret writing, fashioning an improvised concealment, and burying microdots. The objective was to introduce case officers to a variety of technical tools and familiarize them with the operational capabilities available through OTS. OTS technical operations officers, known as TOOs, who were trained specifically for field assignments, came from all disciplines, including documents, disguise, audio, and secret writing. After acquiring proficiency in each of the other areas, their primary expertise was then matched with the overriding need of an office. In the early 1970s, the prevailing requirement in Moscow was support for covert photography used for operational casing. Depending on circumstances, Moscow officers would use commercial 35mm or special sub-miniature cameras to photograph persons or equipment of interest, as well as locations for meetings, dead drops, and signal sites. A favorite small camera was the Tessina, which took a half-format image using 35mm film to produce 72 exposures instead of the standard 36, and featured a spring-wound motor that allowed for one-handed operation and 10 exposures before rewinding, eliminating the need to remove the camera from its concealment after each shot. The techs also made concealments for these casing cameras, incorporating them into purses, little leather pouches, and books. Case officers returning from an operational photography mission, called a casing run,